you knew this big thing was happening in front of your eyes, but you couldn't acknowledge it.
Staff cuts at the Alaska Dispatch News. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, commercial marijuana growers boost revenue for Golden Valley Electric Association.
We're running at full capacity at our facility right now, and our monthly power bill comes in just under $20,000.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The future of the Affordable Care Act appears to rest on what Senator Lisa Murkowski will do next week. And that means Alaska is getting a lot of extra attention, including a special caller to an Anchorage conservative talk radio program today.
President, and I believe joining me now via the newsmaker line is the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence. Mr. Vice President, welcome to the Dave Steering Show.
Hi, Dave. Mike Pence here. It's great to be with you. Great to be on the air on KFQD. Thanks for having me on.
Vice President Pence called KFQD to make a pitch for the latest Republican bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Supporters hope it will pass the Senate next week. Both sides, for and against, are vying for Murkowski's vote. The state's largest newspaper has begun deep cuts to its staff as it struggles to emerge from bankruptcy under new owners. The Alaska Dispatch News laid off a number of employees this week. But as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, there's no word from its new management on whether this is the end of reductions.
Word spread quickly on Wednesday that staffers at the ADN were being let go.
David Hewland, the executive editor, was tapping people on the shoulder and calling them into his office.
Jeanette Lee Falsey covered business at the ADN. She was one of the people tapped on the shoulder and laid off soon after.
If you walked into that newsroom and hadn't known the state of things, you would not have known that people were being laid off. It was all very quiet and done very discreetly, and that was to protect people's privacy as much as possible.
Lee Falsey says the layoffs began at the end of last week, and the mood in the office was tense.
You knew this big thing was happening in front of your eyes, but you couldn't acknowledge it, which for people who are used to being open and communicative is a very difficult thing.
In her reporting, Lee Falsey says she tended to pick stories that were complicated and took a little longer to finish, which is not necessarily the trend in daily newspaper journalism. And being a business reporter, she knew the new owners of ADN would have to shed employees in order to reduce costs.
I had some irons in the fire because I saw this coming, and in these types of situations, no one is safe.
The layoffs come as the paper is emerging from the brink of financial collapse. Earlier this month, when a judge approved the sale of the paper to the Binkley family of Fairbanks for $1 million, staff were told layoffs would be part of the effort to rein in multi-million dollar annual losses. According to bankruptcy filings, ADN had just over 200 employees. Reached by cell phone, publisher Ryan Binkley wouldn't comment on the full number of layoffs. He pointed to a short article on page 5 of Wednesday's paper, saying it had all the information that would be released. The story calls the staff reductions significant, but doesn't say how many people were let go. Binkley declined to answer any questions, saying his Uber driver was waiting. Michael Carey is a retired editorial page editor of the paper and still contributes pieces occasionally.
What's really striking to me is how many of the people who were laid off have had a significant long role in Alaska journalism.
Carey says the loss of institutional knowledge is tremendous. He thinks this is among the worst days in the history of Alaska journalism. During his career, Carey says he saw plenty of layoffs, but none this big in such a short time.
My guess is they wanted to do it all at once, and they did it all at once.
Carrie rattled off the names of almost a dozen colleagues let go in the last week, many of whom had more than three decades with the paper as sports writers, editors, photographers, and reporters. The paper is still looking for ways to cut expenses, including changes to leased space and the operation of its printing press. The sole employee at the paper's bureau in Bethel wrote on Facebook she's moving back to Anchorage, and the one staff writer based in Fairbanks was among those let go. A letter on the front page from editor David Hewlin this week notes the paper is scaling back to just two sections for most weekdays, with content focusing more on news in Anchorage and South Central Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Interior Energy Project has achieved a major milestone. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority Board today approved a plan advancing the state effort to increase availability of natural gas in Fairbanks. The board action hinged on a recently secured Cook Inlet gas supply contract with Hillcorp. ADA Interior Energy Project team leader Jean Terrio says the gas supply is a key plan component required by enabling legislation.
Basically means that now the project has access to all of the financial tools that were provided by the legislature.
Terrio points to a $300 million mix of capital, loan, and bonding capacity to help pay for project expenses, including Cook Inlet LNG processing plant expansion and additional gas storage in Fairbanks. The Interior Energy Project targets a consumer gas price equivalent to $2 a gallon. Terrio says the current contract alone does not get there, but projections indicate it's achievable as new customers sign up for service.
To spread these fixed costs, bring the cost down, and make the delivered cost even that much more attractive to businesses and more attractive to residential customers, too.
Still at issue for advancing the project is whether the Fairbanks North Star Borough's Interior Gas Utility will buy and merge operations with Fairbanks Natural Gas. Golden Valley Electric Association says its membership includes 47 commercial marijuana growers who paid the co-op more than $500,000 over the past year for the electricity they use. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Figures released this week by Golden Valley show a steady month-to-month growth in revenues from commercial marijuana cultivators who do business in the GVEA service area. The growers paid a total of about $7,600 in August 2016, and last month their payments totaled just over $92,000.
Golden Valley has seen a continuous increase in the amount of kilowatt hours used by marijuana grow operations. And dollar-wise, the amount of revenue that's come in from those growers has increased as well.
Golden Valley President and CEO Corey Borgeson says some of the operations are fairly large and require industrial-scale components to handle the amount of electricity needed to run grow lights and maintain climate control.
Many times the customers will need to come in with engineers' reports because they're fairly large loads and they take fairly large transformers.
Fairbanks grower Nathan Davis says that's true, and that's why he worked with an engineer from the very beginning when he was first planning his 21,000-square-foot growing operation located in an industrial area on the city's south side.
You don't build a facility of this size without having an engineering firm involved, so we had our ducks in a row. We knew what size transformers we needed, and we knew what they wanted from us, and we provided it.
Davis says he uses energy-saving technology when he can, like the LED fixtures that comprise about a quarter of his 300 growing lights. But he says he still runs up a hefty monthly light bill.
We're running at full capacity at our facility right now, and our monthly power bill comes in just under $20,000.
Borgeson says the co-op tracks the grower's electricity use based on the information they provide when they apply for service. And he says GVEA knows if the growers have been licensed. That information is readily available on the State Marijuana Control Board's website. And Borgeson says so far the growers have been good customers.
We've had no problems or any issues with our marijuana growers.
Borgeson talked about the revenue from pot growers during last month's GVEA Board of Directors meeting. He provided a spreadsheet of those earnings over the past year upon request by KUAC. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for much of the Kenai River drainage due to the release of water from a dammed glacial lake. The flood watch goes into effect Friday morning through Monday morning for Kenai Lake and the upper Kenai River from Cooper Landing to Skelak Lake. In addition, water levels on the lower Kenai River from Skelak Lake to Cook Inlet are expected to rise to bank full conditions as well. The cause of the flooding is the release of water backed up by the Snow Glacier, which began overnight. The Weather Service says there is considerable uncertainty of the volume of water being released and how fast it will drain, though it is coinciding with several days of forecast heavy rain. The Weather Service projects that the Primrose Campground on the east end of Kenai Lake and other low-lying areas will be flooded by Friday afternoon. Water is expected to continue to rise on the Snow and Kenai Rivers and Kenai Lake into early next week. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, residents of Gamble celebrate a new clinic.
It is a lifelong desire to actually work out of a new facility large enough to serve the population.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The 10 Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils are conducting meetings from late September through November to discuss proposals for federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations and other issues. Public participation is encouraged. Information at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The operator of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is reporting an oil spill at the marine terminal in Valdez. Alaska Pipeline Service Company estimates the volume of crude oil spilled to be less than 100 gallons. Crews reported seeing a sheen on the water at about 11:30 today. Alaska says the spill is not ongoing and the cause is under investigation. The spill area has been boomed and teams are now skimming the water to try to recover the oil. Alaska reports there have been no impacts to wildlife or injuries associated with the incident. A Fort Wainwright soldier is charged with assaulting his infant son. Fairbanks police say 22-year-old Ronald L. McGriff was arrested Wednesday and charged with first-degree assault for severely injuring his 8-month-old son last month. Police say McGriff admitted to kicking, striking, shaking, and throwing the baby, actions that resulted in severe brain bleeding and other injuries. They say the child remains hospitalized in Seattle and is expected to have permanent damage. Police ask that anyone with information about the assault to contact them. The Alaska Marine Highway System could shut down this spring. A little-known budget provision will pull about $23 million out of the system's spending for this fiscal year. It's to make up for a shortfall in state health care funding. Pat Pitney, the governor's budget director, described the problem in a Tuesday letter to House and Senate finance leaders. Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman told those at the Southeast Conference's annual meeting in Haines that lawmakers should fix the problem. Otherwise, the ferry system will run out of money in April.
They will not have the authority to run the system if the legislature does not appropriate the money, period.
If the funding isn't replaced, the ferry system will have to wait until the new budget year, which begins in July, to resume sailings. Transportation Commissioner Mark Lukien doesn't expect that to happen.
I think what we need to really focus on, and this is what certainly I think the administration is going to be focused on, is, you know, how do we restore that funding? How do we make sure that that funding is there so that we can continue to, you know, fulfill the commitment that we have to coastal Alaskans?
Pitney detailed the shortfall in her letter. She said a spending bill meant to plug budget holes called for a marine highway account to fill those gaps if there wasn't enough money. So when Medicaid spending was higher than planned, the $30 million ferry account lost about 3/4 of its balance. Pitney's letter doesn't assign blame, but Stedman pointed to Senate budget writers who think the ferry system is too expensive.
2 years ago, roughly, there was some language put in the operating budget, and I got to hand it to the guys. They're very creative in the skullduggery and the downright sleazy budgeting that went on. It got by the Department of Law, it got by the administration, it got by my office. and it was triggered this year.
Pitney said the governor will seek to restore the funding through a supplemental budget bill when the legislature convenes early next year. Steadman said it will take a strong effort by the governor and the state house to get it through. Scientists are trying to better understand how the world's fish will adapt to climate change. One recent finding, as temperatures rise, new species could move into Alaska waters. Researchers from the University of Washington used 80 years of data to figure out how much warming fish could withstand. They discovered fish in the tropics are already living in water at the upper end of their threshold. Migrating to cooler waters could be their best option for survival. As that occurs, Alaska waters could become a host to new kinds of marine life. Already, tropical species like ocean sunfish have been spotted in the state. Scientists say they need more information to determine how local environments could be affected as new fish arrive and compete for food. A strong Chum salmon run is helping pay for upgrades to a Sitka hatchery. Returns are also good at a much larger aquaculture operation not far away. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Angie Bowers walks toward a concrete and metal channel next to the Sheldon Jackson hatchery.
These are our adult spawning raceways. So the returning salmon come up here, and this is where we're able to crowd them up and harvest them and either take their eggs, or oftentimes if they're not ready, we'll put them back in that far raceway for another day.
Bowers oversees the hatchery as aquaculture director for the Sitka Sound Science Center, where it's located. It raises pinks and cohos, as well as chums, and is part of the center's hatchery training program. She says this year's run was better than expected, but it wasn't a big surprise. The hatchery tripled its chum release to about 3 million 4 years ago, and the species has its strongest returns in its fourth year.
Wasn't a great return, but they're a lot more valuable than the pinks that we've harvested in the past, so it was a good boost for our cost recovery.
The hatchery brought in about 16,000 chums from the raceway or a recovery seine fishery. It's a small number compared to larger hatcheries and commercial harvests, but it made 10% more than its $100,000 recovery goal, and that's enough to move forward with an important addition to its egg room.
Chum incubators. So these are, each box has about 180,000 eggs in it right now. And eventually, probably in about 3 weeks, we'll pull all those out and we pick all the dead out, and then they get reseeded back into the boxes.
The addition is pretty simple. It's a sump, a concrete lined hole in the floor that will collect and reuse the egg room's water. That might not sound like a big deal, but Bowers says it's important since the operation gets its fresh water from a variable source.
In the past, they've had a lot of mortality in incubation because of the high silt load in Indian River. And so having the ability to put those eggs on full recirc whenever we see a storm coming, or eventually when there's low water in the river and we can use conservation measures for the wild fish that are there.
The Science Center's hatchery is not the only place seeing strong runs.
Chum salmon returns were very good throughout the whole state. This is close to a record year for chum returns.
Steve Reifenstuhl is general manager of the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. The Sitka-based nonprofit runs large multi-species hatcheries that release fish around the region. His operation has had mixed chum returns this year, depending on the site. But generally, it's been good.
And it's been several years since I've felt this sunny at the end of the season, and I think there's some good things to come here in the next few years.
He says there's been no problems with the cost recovery fisheries, and some commercial openings have brought in more chums than usual. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Sitka.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Juneau's Housing First project is opening its doors this week to the first 8 residents. KTOO's Jacob Resnick took a tour inside the $8.3 million Lemon Creek complex.
The 32 apartments in the Housing First building are basic, almost institutional with their low single beds. But then there are the little touches that show just how much community support has gone into the project. The Gold Street Quilters donated 32 handmade quilts with the names of each resident embroidered inside.
And so every unit gets a quilt, and then every quilt, it says like exactly who it's for and their name.
And Maria Lovishuk leads the tour. She runs the Glory Hole Downtown Shelter and Soup Kitchen and has been Housing First's project manager.
So this is the little communal area. There's going to be TV here.
Similar facilities already exist in Anchorage and Fairbanks. It starts as no-strings housing for homeless people.
And the idea is that just having housing, you know, like nice housing, in itself is a stabilizing force in people's lives. And what we know from other projects is even though people don't have to participate in services, when we don't have to participate in services, they participate a lot more than when they have to do it as a condition of something.
Essential services from medical care to counseling are available. There's also a to-be-completed downstairs clinic. A physician's assistant will be on site for urgent care. Mental health services will also be offered. The Juneau Assembly has provided $2.7 million in public money to help finance the project. Other donors followed. Businesses provided in-kind services and materials. Tenants pay rent on a sliding scale.
You pay 30% of your income to rent, and it gets reassessed every month by the landlord. And so if your income is zero, then your rent is zero. But if your income is, you know, $1,100 a month, then you pay 30% of that.
And the thinking goes, as people become settled, productivity increases.
Actually, and the idea is that in this project is that people come in with very little income initially, but once they stabilize, they do bring more income in, their income increases.
So will it work?
We want to do an evaluation of the program and demonstrate the benefits of Housing First in Juneau.
That's Jeanette Lacey. She's the lead social worker at Bartlett Regional Hospital and a Housing First board member. She'll also be working with researchers from University of Alaska Fairbanks, which will be using this as a case study.
The Housing First program in Juneau has obviously learned from the lessons of other programs throughout the nation, and so what we've tried to do with our program is to take what's been working and try to redesign some things that maybe didn't go as well, and so we want to just evaluate the process that we have here and also, you know, have something to give back to the community to demonstrate what we're seeing as the outcomes from the project.
Daisha Davis is the newly hired program director who will oversee the complex's 8 staffers. She brings with her 14 years of experience in social work.
I see it as a learning experience, and we're going to grow a lot this year and just every day kind of adjust and be flexible and meet the needs of the program and the tenants.
The first 10 residents are set to move in the next week. Organizers hope it'll be quiet and under the radar as people settle in. Batches of 10 residents will move in every 10 to 14 days until all 32 apartments are filled. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
After several years of providing community health services in an overcrowded building, Norton Sound Health Corporation employees in Gamble on St. Lawrence Island now have a bigger and newer space to accommodate the community's needs. KNOM's Davis Hovey has more.
Good morning, Gamble Clinic. This is Maggie.
Here at the new Gamble Clinic, there's a full waiting room of adults and about 10 school kids who are taking time off from class to update their physicals. Other patients are visiting the clinic to get a blood test.
And here's our little blood draw chair table.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Shanna Kuzada, the lead health aide, has been working with the Gamble Clinic in 2 different buildings since 2011. As Kuzada shows me around the freshly painted blue and white health facility, she exclaims that this place is significantly bigger than the old clinic.
Oh my gosh, the space is, there was not much space. And there were more exam rooms than what we have now at the new clinic.
Despite having fewer exam rooms, Kuzada says the new clinic building can better accommodate more patients. And many of those patients have generally reacted positively to the more modern clinic. In fact, Cusada recalls that some people, when they walk in, forget they're still on St. Lawrence Island.
Whenever they come in, they tell us they feel like they're not in Gamble because, you know, a new building.
Lucia Paticky is the Vice President for Community Health Services with the Norton Sound Health Corporation and has been living in Gamble her entire life. For Paticky, this new clinic represents the fulfillment of a dream.
It is a lifelong desire to actually work out of a new facility large enough to serve the population. Yeah, for a number of years, we've had to work out of the old clinic, which had very limited space and got really crowded, especially when we had people come out, doctor's visits, supervisor instructors, you know, and from providers from different departments.
Apatagi also mentioned that the main advocate for the new clinic, who put in about 20 years of time and effort to make this project happen, was June Walunga. Walunga, who is the NSHC board member for Gamble, was unavailable for comment before the airing of this story. Even though the upgraded health facility is open for business, boxes still need to be unpacked and the old building needs to be decommissioned. As the transition phase is ongoing, Edna Apatiki, who works in behavioral health services at the Gamble Clinic, has been struggling to complete the online portion of her work.
Because I have some issues with downloading and the computer's locked, and we have to tell the technical folks over at Norton Sound to request services from them.
In spite of technical difficulties, Apatiki says she still sees her clients in person and continues her daily activities in a new building that has more reliable water and sewer access.
About transitioning over here is amazing. It's quite modern here, and we don't have that old carpet anymore. It collects dust and we breathe in the dust, but we're very fortunate to be here.
Once the old clinic is decommissioned and the transition is completely done, Lucy Apatiki says she would like for Norton Sound Health Corporation clinics to become more integrated and shift their focus to a newer model of healthcare.
I would like to see a lot more, instead of acute care, branching out to other prevention type healthcare, prenatals, women's health. Would like to focus around that so that it's not just all a reaction to what's coming in, but, you know, long-term look at, you know, empowering the people to take ownership of their own health.
One of the 15 other clinics in the area is located in Savunga. Savunga's new health clinic also officially opened within the last week. It began seeing patients on Monday. Reporting in Gamble, I'm Davis Havi.
And finally tonight, a correction. In a story last night, we reported that over half of the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska is off limits to oil drilling. In fact, just over half of NPRA is open to drilling. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Jay Barrett in Kenai, Elizabeth Jenkins and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, and Davis Hovey in Gamble. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.